From the Hmong Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. More controversy over Senate Bill 50, which would allow for apartment buildings to be built in single-family neighborhoods throughout California. Senator Scott Wiener's bill already rejected by the San Francisco and L.A. city councils. A new study out of L.A. shows what the effects would be on suburban neighborhoods. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you're having a great start to your day. Got a lot of big topics to talk about this morning, including public transit with Phil Washington, the CEO of LA Metro. We'll talk about his department's plans to try and build ridership back up after it's declined in Southern California and across the country generally. The rise of ride-hailing services and the abundant used car market all have made it very difficult for public transit. We'll talk about that challenge. But first, we begin with efforts to develop more housing around public transit. That is the idea behind State Senator Scott Wiener's bill, SB 50, that is being heard in a committee today in Sacramento. It would have a far-reaching effect on the housing market in California, designed to provide for higher density construction, which would override local zoning restrictions in many communities. Already, the LA City Council and the San Francisco Board of Supervisors have unanimously voted against SB 50. Last week, I spoke with Governor Newsom on the occasion of his first 100 days in office. And I talked with him about the votes of the city councils and the pushback against a bill that would seemingly allow for demolition of single-family homes and replacement with apartment buildings.
The answer is one size doesn't fit all, and that's the struggle the senator has, not only this year, but he had this last year when he had a similar bill. Communities are different. Transit corridors are defined differently in different communities. Some communities are more dense, others less so. West sides versus east sides of communities are radically different. So that's the struggle. Look, I'm not applying any recommendation here. I'm just applying the larger thrust that we've got to go from an annual production of about 100,000 housing units in California closer to 300,000 to 400,000 if we're going to deal with the issue of affordability and the crisis. We can oppose things. We could deny others their proposals or their approaches. But I think collectively we together have to own up to the production gap. And we're going to have to focus on the smartest ways of producing. And I do think that's density around transit corridors. But again, appreciating the nuance to which you have described and the complexity to which you described this issue. And that's why I think the bill is struggling. The bill just struggled last year. But the stress and emphasis on getting housing going and moving again, I think, is an important one.
All right. We're talking about the SB 50, which is State Senator Scott Wiener's bill. He had a similar bill last year, which was not passed. And apparently the senator is working on amending the bill to deal with cities' concerns right now. But yesterday, the LA City Planning Commission issued a report which looked at what the effects of SB 50 would be if it's passed and implemented. David Ambrose is the past president of the Planning Commission. Thank you, sir, for joining us again on Air Talk.
Of course, Larry. Glad to be with you.
What would the effect of this be in single-family communities where you've got highly used bus lines, you've got job centers, and you've even got metro transit locations not far away, places like West L.A., the San Fernando Valley? What would be the effect?
Well, first of all, the bill is undergoing major amendments today. As far as I understand, it's still in the process. And it's a bold proposal to address the housing crisis that the governor just addressed in your previous kind of lead-in. The city would be impacted 63% of LA's developable area. However, after other factors are taken into account, 43% of the city would be impacted by it. It would be all eligible areas, but would be different according to the current zoning, the existing use, existing physical restraints, with the largest impact probably in lower densities that are within a half mile of a rail station or about 6% of single family zoned areas.
So you've got a lot of areas on the west side of Los Angeles, communities like Sherman Oaks, where you've got single-family homes that come right up to the commercial districts that are very close to high-usage transit lines. If SB 50 is passed, would that enable the homeowners in those communities, if they wanted to cash out, to sell their homes to developers and apartment buildings be built on those sites?
Well, like so many other areas and so many other cities in the country and California, many homes are adjacent to transit lines. And I don't know that the bill would impact people's land use abilities or, excuse me, their rights as landowners to sell or buy. Certainly, one could imagine that there might be an increase in value of the residences that would now be able to be further developed without the longer process that currently exists today.
Well, yeah, because I'm thinking if someone's looking at cashing out with a home sale, perhaps they're getting, you know, closer to retirement, whatever, this could be a boon to those homeowners because they would be able to sell their homes, because if a developer comes in and puts up multi-units on that property, it'd make the land even more valuable, wouldn't it?
Well, I think the bill is evolving, and I think the question it's trying to address is an even more pressing question as opposed to the economics as you've been describing. I think the pressing question we have as a state is how are we going to deal with the affordable housing crisis? The governor spoke to the gap that we currently have. So, yes, certainly there are some economic concerns that you're raising that the developers and single-family homeowners may benefit or be impacted. Absolutely. That's certainly a possibility and a likelihood. But I do think it's a bold proposal that is still being refined, and many more questions still exist. But it certainly begins to address that question that we as a state have to wrestle with more aggressively and more aggressively as a city, not just the affordable housing crisis, but the homelessness crisis. This may not be the answer, but it's certainly a answer, and it continues to evolve. And I know I personally have questions, and many stakeholders do, but the process, I think, is going to be rich, and it's ongoing.
We're talking with David Ambrose, past president of the L.A. City Planning Commission, which did a report looking at what the effects would be of SB 50 if it's passed by the legislature, signed by Governor Newsom, and implemented. The L.A. City Council has come out unanimously against it. San Francisco's Board of Supervisors, too. The concerns that have been expressed by those council members and supervisors is that it overrides local zoning and planning efforts where cities are trying to find ways of accommodating additional construction and higher density in some communities. And cities, of course, are getting pushback from residents of some of those areas who are concerned that apartment buildings are going to dramatically change the character of those neighborhoods, the removal of yards with dense buildings without having the same sort of parking requirements that exist currently, that all of this and accompanying traffic is going to have a negative effect on quality of life. I'd love to hear from you if you're an AirTalk listener. A number of homeowner associations have also come out against SB 50. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. David Ambrose, looking at the effects of SB 50 on so much of the city, I wouldn't think that this is going to change any minds of the city council. What do you think, looking at potential amendments, might change LA City Council members' views of the legislation?
I think local impact, local control, and local input makes projects more successful. Every project I've seen come before the commission that takes into account the council office and the community concerns is a better project for that neighborhood and for the city at large. I don't think that process is going to be ignored. I think the council has a very strong role to play in all development in the city, and there's a lot of questions that still exist. You mentioned that it would override some things and not others. That's very clear. There are some very clear statements of policies that would continue to exist, but other ones, it's less clear. And I know that amendments are currently happening today, And there's a lot of questions that I think I still have, and I'm sure others in the city have, about what policies will supersede or be superseded by this.
And, I mean, just what's your personal view as a member of the Planning Commission about having the construction of apartments go into single-family neighborhoods? I'm thinking about, you know, we saw building booms back in the 1980s here where you'd have, you know, a nice little home with a backyard and then a large apartment building go up next to it. They'd be looming over the single-family residence. Would you be okay with that sort of development happening again?
I would answer your question slightly differently and just say I personally spent 11 years homeless myself, and I think in our city we have to have a different conversation about what our priorities are. We have a large number of people that are unhoused, and we have a process that has led to the current situation. So I think you raise an important point of view that cannot and should not be ignored, but perhaps we might want to wrestle with the unhoused and the affordability crisis and kind of get to that answer concurrently, because it's as important as people's right to not be, as you said, loomed over by a new multifamily building.
So where do you, I mean, there, like every other public policy, there are trade-offs involved. So when you look at that trade-off, street of single-family homes and the potential for apartments to be constructed for higher density versus keeping it the way it is, would you lean toward creation of the housing that's the greater public good?
You know, if only the position were that powerful. You know, my role is really to advise the council and the mayor on these issues as part of a body, and we have, the department has done so with this report. You know, my personal opinions aside, I think this is a bold step that continues to be needed to evolve, and a lot of questions remain. But my personal opinion is this is a step forward. However, many, many questions remain. Would I encourage or value more housing in our city? Absolutely. Would I think that we need to refine and reform the processes that can cause years of delay? Absolutely. We have to wrestle with NIMBYism. But there are real concerns neighbors and council offices have that have to be respected. But we've got to balance that with these larger questions. You know, where is our common humanity? What is our priority in this conversation? I think this bill and the amendments and the conversation it's driving are a good step. But at the end of the day, the analysis the department put out kind of explains some of the unknowns. And those are questions that the city, I think, has a right to kind of figure out in conjunction with the legislative process in Sacramento with Scott's leadership.
I want to thank you, David Ambrose, as always, for joining us. We appreciate your talking about this report that came out of the L.A. City Planning Commission. Thank you. Past president of the L.A. City Planning Commission, David Ambrose, joining us on Air Talk. Also with us, Ethan Elkind, who is with the UC Berkeley, UCLA Climate Change and Business Research Initiative. He leads that effort between the two UCs. He directs the climate program as well at UC Berkeley at the Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment. Ethan Elkind, good to have you with us again. You have any sense of what amendments are being made to the bill today?
Yeah, no, Larry, first of all, good to be back with you. And as David said, this bill is being amended right now in committee. There was a bit of a showdown with the state senator representing part of the wine country in the North Bay of the San Francisco Bay Area, who had a sort of competing bill. And the basic compromise here now is that SB 50 no longer will apply to counties of less than 600,000 residents, unless there are cities within those counties that are of population 50,000 or greater and have a rail or a ferry terminal in them. That's when SB 350 would apply. So much more surgical in those smaller counties. And then as part of the compromise, it sounds like statewide fourplexes would be legalized by right, meaning you wouldn't have to have the standard permitting process in local jurisdictions. So that looks like another compromise. But I think the key thing here is with the 600,000 population county threshold now, it's taking off the table the rural part of California, many of the interior counties. I would note that includes both Sonoma and Marin counties in the Bay Area and then Santa Barbara County in the Southland. So So that's the latest amendments that we, and then more information will be coming out, but that's what we're hearing from the pretty big committee hearing this morning. This was going to be a big hurdle potentially for SB 50. So the fact that there are these compromises and the bill is still going forward is a pretty big deal.
What about, you mentioned that fourplexes, would that mean that anybody who wants to knock down a single family home, we're within these areas close enough to transit corridors or facilities, they could knock it down, they could put up a fourplex without having to get local approval for that?
So we're still waiting on details on these amendments. They've just been announced from the dais, but it looks like it's not that you can demolish to build a fourplex, but you can internally subdivide and remodel an existing structure. That's what Scott Wiener, the state senator, author of the bill, has tweeted out. So it wouldn't be a demo situation. It would be a subdivision within the existing framework of the building.
All right. And, you know, so many of the concerns from neighborhood groups are about demolition of single-family homes, construction of apartment buildings, something, you know, we've seen in the past in Southern California. Would this bill allow for that to be done without the community essentially being able to stop that kind of construction?
Sure. Well, you know, there's a fair amount of misinformation, and it's a complicated bill. You know, but the basic idea with SB 50 is that it creates a floor for some of the zoning, local zoning, the land use rules that govern what can be built. And so that relates to how dense a project can be. And in this case, it's saying no density limits no parking requirements above a half stall of parking per unit. The height limits have a floor of 45 feet. Within a half mile, which is about four stories, within a half mile of rail or high-quality bus, and five stories for a quarter mile. And then there are some other density-type relaxations. But it doesn't apply everywhere. So in addition to that kind of radius around major transit, it's not going to apply to any parcel where, and this is to your question about demolition, to any parcel where there are tenants who are especially low-income tenants who have been evicted within the past, I believe it's 7 years, although a lot of this language is still subject to change. But so there's some really strict provisions in there to prevent displacement of low-income renters in particular. It also takes off the table, doesn't apply at all to areas that are at risk of gentrification. And so it's low-income areas, which actually represent some pretty wide swaths of Los Angeles, the San Francisco Bay Area, although the precise definition is still to be determined.
Yeah, because I thought in this report they said it would have a significant effect on South Los Angeles.
You know, it's going to be hard to tell because this definition of what a sensitive community is at risk of gentrification still has to be worked out. So that's not really a final thing. But if that community does count as sensitive and at risk of gentrification, then it basically gets a pass on SB 50 for until 2025, and the community has to come up with their own plan to how they will accommodate new growth in a way that won't displace low-income tenants.
Let's talk with Patricia in Palms. What do you think of SB 50 and its potential effects?
I think it would totally destroy neighborhoods, and I think it should be a conversation since it is so dramatic. It should be a conversation within the citizens of the entire state.
What do you mean by that?
Everybody should have a conversation in this. It should be something we all vote on. We should talk about. It should not be something that's done by a small committee of people who have special interests. There are some people who call this bill WIMBY, a Wall Street in my backyard. It's not what it appears to be of trying to favor our housing problem. That's not what it is.
So you think it's on behalf of developers. Now, you're a homeowner, right, Patricia? So wouldn't this potentially be a boon for you because you could sell your property to a developer and cash out big?
That idea, that concept is a terrible concept. When an individual thinks, oh boy, let the prices go up and I'm going to make big, and they totally forget that it destroys the neighborhood. That's something that it's a hard issue to resolve. However, that your statement's inaccurate. I feel as a homeowner, I would not be able to sell to any individual. I could only sell to a developer. Because an individual would say, oh, I can only stay here a short time because then I could be surrounded by these huge monolithic apartment buildings.
What would you say, though, to housing construction advocates who could say, look, Southern California could be able to accommodate these kinds of neighborhoods with backyards and lower density neighborhoods in the past, but those days are gone. There are just too many people. That's a way of life of the past, and those neighborhoods are largely going to have to change and go away. What's your response to that?
It's not true. I think it's inappropriate for a committee of people to act like dictators and tell us how we're supposed to live. I think it's a conversation that humanity can handle.
All right, Patricia, appreciate your call. I thank you very much for being with us. Let me take another call from Kelly in Echo Park. You're on Air Talk.
Yeah, hi. I do have concerns about density, but I'm also concerned that as we build more, we're not addressing the infrastructure. So how are we going to handle traffic? What's happening with the power grids? Never mind the traffic just in the individual neighborhoods, but between neighborhoods, across cities, across the state. Do we have enough water? And what about emergency services? What about the streets themselves? We're spending so much time talking about what it does to the neighborhoods, but no one's ever saying, yeah, and as we're putting in construction that will accommodate 20,000 extra people, what are we doing to make sure that we can actually handle all those extra people?
Well, I think the view of supporters is that more people will walk, they'll ride bicycles, they'll ride buses, that they won't all be coming with their cars or driving them so much. Ethan Elkind, can you speak to that?
Yeah, well, I think that's really the whole purpose of the bill and limiting it to proximity to high-quality transit is that you're going to see much higher transit usage, and that if we're going to have growth anywhere in California, it really ought to be near this existing infrastructure as opposed to putting it farther and farther out from job centers so we have people with these mega commutes driving in, clogging up the freeways, polluting, creating terrible air quality for all of us who live in the city. So this is the logical place for California to grow, near our transit nodes and also close to jobs. That's also why the bill says that growth should occur where there are communities that are affluent, that have a lot of jobs, but haven't allowed the housing. And I also would add that with new residents comes more tax revenue. And so the tax revenue can help cover a lot of these infrastructure costs. And that's why the bill doesn't override a lot of the permitting processes. So some of these impacts can be worked out that way.
Now, with lessening the parking requirements for the property, though, this is sort of based on the fact that not everybody's going to have a car. But what we've seen, as I understand, with transit-centric housing to this point is everybody still has a car. They still use their vehicle often to commute, even if they live adjacent to a light rail station. But they like the idea of living in sort of a happening place where you've got transit around, even if they don't use it. Are you concerned, Ethan, that you're going to end up with just many, many more cars, a lot more effort to park on the street because there's not garaged parking on site, and it's not going to be this sort of dream that planners have that, you know, everybody's going to be out on their bike or on foot?
Well, we should understand that relaxing parking requirements doesn't mean parking won't get built. It simply means that we're not going to require it where none is in demand. And so it allows developers to make that decision as to how much demand there is for parking in that area. And if there's not much, then let's not build a lot of parking. But I think the reason why people need to buy a car and feel they need to have one is because there aren't other ways to get around. And it's also often very convenient because a lot of that parking infrastructure is subsidized by things like high parking requirements and a lot of auto-oriented infrastructure that taxpayers end up paying for. So if we have proper neighborhood design, we can make it very convenient for people who want to ditch their cars to do so. And you see neighborhoods where that's successful. A lot of parts of San Francisco, for example, where you have professionals who certainly could afford vehicles. There's not a lot of on-site parking. Transit is abundant. They can walk and bike, and they choose to do so, and you don't see a lot of driving. So Los Angeles can certainly make that choice, too. It's a policy choice, how convenient we want to make it for people. people to drive versus being able to ditch their cars and all the expense and hassle that comes with it. So
one of the challenges there, though, I think, Ethan, is that in San Francisco, few of those people have kids. And a lot of the people you're describing who commute into jobs in Los Angeles have families. And I'm not sure you're talking about the same demographic. And the challenge is, what do you do, for families? Because it's not all single people who are employed in Los Angeles.
Well, that's there's some truth to that, but we have to keep in mind families don't make up the majority of the home buyers. Most people who own a home don't have children, and most households don't have children. So we don't have to build just for families. And certainly, we see examples of families living in cities all over the world, from all different income ranges. And there are families in Los Angeles doing the same thing. So it's quite possible to raise a child in an urban environment and get around without a vehicle. We do see that. And if people don't want to do that, they have the option of living out in a single family environment. We just have to make sure that they're paying the true costs of the commuting and the pollution that comes with a lifestyle that's oriented around a large home and an automobile.
Ethan Elkind with us from the UC Berkeley, UCLA Climate Change and Business Research Initiative, which he leads. He directs UC Berkeley's climate program at the Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Phil Washington, the CEO of LA Metro, coming up next. That's appropriate, isn't it? Talking about higher density construction around transit. Phil will talk with us about a number of major initiatives at Metro. Be back in a moment. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle with Phil Washington. He's the CEO of LA Metro and joins us regularly to talk about the top issues in transit. Actually, our first issue that we're going to talk about is a mural that was painted over by a contract company working for LA Metro. The company was charged with cleaning up or covering over graffiti, but that graffiti abatement ended up covering Judith Baca's Hitting the Wall mural. Yesterday, she joined Nick Roman on All Things Considered and had this to say.
It's very profound. I mean, it's not like somebody could do this in a half hour. This is a 35-foot-high mural under the 4th Street exit of the Harbor Freeway, and it's over 100 feet long. So to just put a coat of paint on that requires that you have equipment and ladders and scaffolding, that you're standing on that overpass on the exit for some period of time with trucks and equipment.
That's Judy Baca, the artist, talking about her mural that was painted over. Phil, it's good to have you with us. And first of all, what I've been seeing on television, what must have been the mural after it was first painted, because there you can see the mural fully. Right. We have a photo on our Air Talk site from LAist.com. You can barely see any of the mural there. Mm-hmm. I kind of understand how the contractors covered it up.
Well, yes. And first of all, thank you for having me here again, Larry. It's great to be here. Yes. One of our contractors saw graffiti, did not know the mural was under the graffiti because the mural was completely covered by the graffiti. And so our contractor came there not knowing the mural was under there and did their abatement work to get rid of the graffiti. So we accept full responsibility for that. And our contractor was a little bit overzealous in making sure that the graffiti was gone. The good thing about this is we want to work with the various parties to even see if we can restore it. I was told just yesterday that there may be a way that there's a film on top of the mural that we might be able to recover that. Now, I'm not an expert in that, but we are going to try very, very hard. And the artist has my personal commitment to do what we can to recover that beautiful mural.
Well, I mean, it's, and of course, not just any mural. Judith Baca, a noted muralist, and it's a gorgeous work commissioned for the Olympics, as I recall.
Yes.
And I mean, it's so sad, but it's also sad that it was so heavily tagged beforehand. Whose responsibility is it to clean the mural up so it can be enjoyed as a mural?
Well, that is on Caltrans property, and many times our metro contractors have a partnership with Caltrans that if they see graffiti, somehow they notify Caltrans. I don't know if it was done in this case, but many times Caltrans removes the graffiti. This time our contractor thought they were doing a good thing, apparently. And got rid of the whole thing. So do they
have the equipment to clean? Could they have cleaned the graffiti off and saved the mural? Are they equipped, or do they just, you know, they're not restorers as well as removers?
Yeah, that I'm not sure about. But I think had they known a mural was under it, they would have probably brought in the right equipment to just take the graffiti off. But I don't know if they can restore. But in their defense, they just thought it was just graffiti and they were doing the right thing.
Well, especially if you're at sidewalk level. I mean, you can see the mural just at the very, very top. But you kind of have to be looking for it because 2/3 of the mural's covered with tagging and graffiti. Phil, is there a way of having a list of all these murals so that when the abatement subcontractors go out, they can cross-check a list?
And we have checked on that. There is a list out there. We're working with Caltrans right now to make sure our contractors have that list all over the county. So my understanding is that there is a list. We have to make sure our folks have that list. And that this does not happen again.
We'll continue our conversation with LA Metro CEO Phil Washington. If you have questions for him about public transit, buses, light rail, congestion pricing, which we've talked about here on KPCC, we have many, many different issues to take up. Security when traveling on public transit, 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. Back after a live update from Hetty Lynn Herdes. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us for our regularly scheduled visit by the CEO of LA Metro, Phil Washington, with us. We're taking your questions at 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Joaquin in South LA asks, any updates on Metro's next generation bus study? Bus ridership is hemorrhaging. Buses need to be improved ASAP. Thanks, Joaquin.
Joaquin, we definitely agree with you. We are doing that next-gen study. And what that is we are revamping our entire bus system or service that's on the street right now. This is the first time this has been done at Metro in probably 25 or 30 years, looking at the whole system, understanding that there are new employment centers, there's new residential centers. And so this next-gen effort is looking at, among other things, speeding up our system. Our system is too slow right now, and I'm talking our bus system right now. It's too slow. How can we speed that up? How can we enhance the customer experience? So we're going through that right now. We're doing a lot of outreach. We're making a lot of recommendations. Our hope is to bring the results back to our board later on this year and implement this new next-gen service, bus resurfacing structure on the street.
All right. Also wanted to ask you about where things stand on the study of congestion pricing. We did a segment looking at the west side of Los Angeles as a potential site, and a lot of concerns were raised about that. There are others who advocate for downtown Los Angeles because of the denser population, jobs, public transit. Where do things stand on that project?
Well, let me just say, actually, this month we are bringing to our board, actually tomorrow at our board meeting, we are bringing a scope of work for congestion pricing and the regulation of transportation network companies as well, the Ubers and the Lyfts. So this scope of work that we're bringing to our board for their receive and file and also a timeline says that we will put a request for proposal, an RFP, out on the street for a consultant to help us determine where the pilot area should be for congestion relief. And so we'll put that out. We'll bring a consultant on board to determine where the best pilot area should be. Now, I will say that just in my mind that within that pilot area, not to pre-select any area because we have not done that mm-hmm. yet, but my thought would be that, one, there should be congestion there. And number two, there should be some transit options or some alternatives in that pilot area. And so we're going to put this RFP out. We're going to bring a consultant on. And then after that, we will have we will pilot this in some area of the county to reduce congestion and hopefully eradicate congestion. And we've also said that that we will bring to our board the possibility, if this is structured right, which we hope it will be, the possibility of free transit across the board for everyone first in that pilot area.
All right. Very good. Phil Washington, LA Metro CEO with us. Jack writes on the AirTalk Facebook page, people are not using ride sharing services at the expense of public transit. I don't know where he gets that from, but he said Metro could have solved this years ago by building hundreds of more miles of light rail and adding express tracks like New York City does. Obviously, everything's dependent on the amount of money that you have to spend on projects, and these are massively expensive. New York City built its rail structure, a century ago or something. So, you know, values were much different than today. But what about the express tracks issue that he raises?
Express tracks, yes, New York, some places in Philadelphia. Some of your what's called legacy systems have an express track. And what we're talking about there is the ability for trains to bypass the station and they have express tracks around the station, things like that. It's enormously expensive now to do something like that. Yes, it's effective. You can have an express train that passes multiple stops and things like that. And New York has that. But very, very expensive to do. And right now, just I don't think it's possible to do that here in Los Angeles with our system.
And again, not only is New York's system much, much older, but it's so much smaller.
Yes.
I mean, when you talk about the L.A. County and the massive size to develop a transit system here, the miles that are involved, it's remarkable.
It's pretty incredible. When you think about, 10 plus million people in this county alone, I mean, the last time I looked, this county was larger than 42 states. I mean, it's incredible just the size of this county.
At this point, there's consideration for a tax on Uber and Lyft. And I'm not sure whether that's aimed in controlling the number of cars that are out there waiting for fares or whether it's just a matter of, paying for the infrastructure costs of the additional cars. How do you see this? Do you support there being a tax or surcharge on those?
Well, first of all, I mean, let's recognize that the Ubers and Lyfts of the world do contribute to congestion, and they are using public right-of-way for free, and they're using public right-of-way to enrich a private entity. And so the thought here is that their use of public right of way, you know, we should be thinking about regulating that and charging a fee or them incurring a fee to use public right of way. And so that is what we're looking at. That's one of the things that our board allowed us to move forward on it, you know, along with congestion relief. So we should be looking at that because they contribute to congestion.
I remember last time I was in New York and using ride-hailing services, and right on the app it says you are going to be assessed this, you know, surcharge, this tax that's not us, but that New York applies mm-hmm. to it. It's pretty hefty, as I recall.
It is pretty hefty. It is pretty hefty. I want to say it's about $2.75 a ride.
Yeah,
something
it was.
Like that.
I mean, it adds up if you're using multiple rides a day. And you think about something that would potentially be that high here in L.A.?
Well, we have not settled on what that fee would be. That's something that we're also doing a feasibility study on that issue as well, along with congestion pricing. So it's two feasibility studies that will be going on. And we'll look at what fee is appropriate for our area.
I remember, Phil, not long after the Gold Line opened up and the tracks go down the middle of the 210 Foothill Freeway here in Pasadena, we had, wasn't long after it opened, a particularly horrific accident mm-hmm. with ejections of people on the track. I mean, it's just unspeakably awful. And fears, gosh, are we going to see more of that? And sadly, though maybe not quite as spectacularly awful, we've seen some terrible crashes of trucks going onto the tracks and vehicles. But barriers to install those all along where the light rail goes down, very expensive. Have you done an estimate what it would cost to protect the tracks?
Well, it's going to be expensive. The issue here along the 210 is that the existing barriers are too low. They're about three feet or so.
Truck can go right over
it. A truck can go right over it, and trucks have gone right over it. And so we have taken it upon ourselves at Metro to look to raise the height of barriers. And so we don't have an estimate just now. We're still doing design on the 210 right now to determine if we can get to a level of design in order to make an estimate on the construction. And so we're in the midst of that right now. But we have said that we must replace those barriers, and that is what we're doing with first design of the barriers right now and how we can do that, and then construction of those.
All right, Phil Washington, LA Metro CEO with us. We have many more topics to talk about. We'll also add some of your questions to the mix. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, the CEO of LA Metro. Phil Washington with me. I'm Larry Mantle. Good to have you with us. Dee in Pasadena says to beef up transit, you need smaller electric buses. Sometimes there's hardly anyone on the buses you see on the street. It wastes time and resources. We don't need to spend money putting in express lanes. We need smaller, more environmentally friendly buses. That's something you've looked at, Phil?
We have. First of all, we are our board has directed us to replace our entire fleet of buses, 2,200 buses, to go all electric by 2030. So this is a huge, huge undertaking that we're planning for right now. In terms of smaller buses, we have something called micro transit that we're looking at right now, and we're piloting this in various areas of the county right now. This is smaller vehicles. This is curb-to-curb type service versus a big 40-foot bus. So we're piloting that right now in various areas of the county with the hope of expanding that program. And they're vans. They're pretty much vans. And so We are getting to what the caller is thinking about right now. We are moving towards that in areas that do not require a large bus.
Do you know offhand where a couple of the pilot locations?
One is in the El Monte area. One is in the North Hollywood area. And I forget where the third one is.
Is the El Monte coming off of the busway there along the freeway? Is that one of the...
It's in one of the... In that area. And the idea is... you know, this curb-to-curb type service, you know, mostly it'll take people to the actual bus depot right there at
Yeah, which is so popular. A lot of people ride that busway. All right. Let's share. Jessica in Los Feliz says, are you going to work with Metrolink and Amtrak to add more train schedule time? The main thing that stops me from using the trains is the lack of having them run more frequently.
Absolutely, Jessica. Many people don't realize that we fund Metrolink. We to the tune of about 52% of their budget, we fund Metrolink. We also fund many of the smaller bus companies, whether it's Foothill or other smaller bus companies. So we are working with Metrolink. We work with Metrolink all the time. We think that the service can be enhanced. We don't operate Metrolink. Many people think we operate Metrolink. We just fund Metrolink, but we do have a say in their operation because four of the board members that are on my board, the LA Metro board, are also on the Metrolink board. So we do have some influence there. And I meet with their CEO very often to talk about service and funding and those things.
All right. Phil, overall, LA Metro, like other public transit agencies, are seeing a decline in ridership. We had a listener took issue that it's ride-hailing services. You know, we know clearly that there are a lot more cars on the road. Mm-hmm. Used car sales particularly are booming because mm-hmm. new cars are very expensive. And we know that people are using ride-hailing services. Mm-hmm. Is there something else you think that's behind the decline in ridership?
Well, you know, I think there's a number of things. You mentioned car ownership. That is the big one. The UCLA did a study not long ago, about a year or so ago, that talked about that is the number one reason. I mean, out here in California, there's no snow, there's no ice. I mean, you could probably drive what we used to call a hoopty for 25 years without worried about snow and ice and those things. So car ownership is the big factor here. But the other things, we need to enhance the customer experience on our system. We need to speed up our system. Our buses are in the same traffic as everyone else on city streets. So we need to speed up our service. We need to make sure our service is on time. So there's things that we can do that we are trying to do in the next gen study that was mentioned earlier. So the other thing I would say, you know, ridership is but one factor. We should be thinking about all of the other key performance indicators. We move about 1.2 million people a day. I mean, I would shudder to think if 1.2 million more people were on the road right now. And so we, in terms of performance factors, ridership is one, but many other things go into the benefit of mobility and transit that we're doing.
One of the things we talk about every time you come on is solving the so-called last mile problem.
Yes.
And, you know, that's, of course, where you lose in the competition with the car is that the car can obviously take you door to door to exactly where you need to be. If you can solve that last mile problem in a timely manner, that's going to go a long way. Are you thinking of these vans as a potential solution to that?
Absolutely. This is why we are piloting this micro transit idea, small vans. That last mile, whether it's bikes, whether it's e-scooters, all of these things, we are thinking very, very hard about the last mile piece. So I think we're on to something with microtransit. I really do. I also think we're on to something with our bike program as well. So the last mile is not – that issue is not unique to Los Angeles County, of course. I think we're on to something, to figuring out how we can make it easier for people to get off either a bus or a train and get to their house that may be a mile away.
It's not unique to here. I mean, Denver is another example,
yes.
Atlanta. I mean, you've got a lot of cities that got this issue. But then you've got others that people always want to compare us with, New York City or San Francisco, which it is much less of an issue because of the density of jobs, so many people going to the same, you know, square mile and it being walkable to get to the place that you work.
That's
and
right.
Here, there's just the odds it's going to be walkable from the transit stop to where you work. Pretty slim odds.
Yeah, it's pretty slim. But, you know, your previous guests and the callers were talking about transit and density and all of that. We're in that business as well to make our station areas more vibrant. And that means density. That means affordable housing. That means attainable housing. And so our joint development program is very, very active in working with developers to put residential near our stations in that 2.5 mile radius. So we are very, very active in that space. We have demonstration projects and pilot joint development projects all over the county.
Robin Mid-Wilshire, quick question. How did the Earth Day free pass for Metro work? Did you see higher ridership?
Yes, we did, Rob. And every time we have last year's Earth Day, even though we don't have the numbers for this year just yet, it was almost a 6% increase, between 6 and 10% increase on ridership.
Wow.
On our system.
And you got Get On Board Day is tomorrow?
Get On Board Day is tomorrow. This is a nationwide effort to say take transit and the benefits of transit. 300 agencies around the country will be participating.
All right. Very good. Thank you for joining us on the
Absolutely.
Day before a Board Day, a Get On Board yes. Day here in Los Angeles.
Thank you.
Phil Washington, CEO of LA Metro.
My true love was true. Oh, 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 I must reply. Something here inside cannot be denied.
Well, smoke may get in your eyes in Southern California. Unfortunately, it also gets in your lungs. We know the long-term negative health effects of smog as well. Good to have you with us on Air Talk as we get an updated look at air pollution in Southern California. Now, if you're a longtime resident of L.A., it's maybe harder to get excited about poor air quality now because we know how it used to be. I used to look up from my office, and this isn't all that long ago, at Pasadena City College, up to the San Gabriel Mountains, just a couple of miles away, nothing, just a wall of gunk in the air. And days like that are very, very rare now in Southern California. Nonetheless, we have the most recent American Lung Association State of the Air annual report showing the Los Angeles-Long Beach region is the most polluted when it comes to ozone of any place in the country. Joining us from the South Coast Air Quality Management District, Deputy Executive Officer Philip Fine. Philip, good to have you with us today.
Good morning, Larry. Great to be on your show again.
So the good news is we've come a long way, baby. But the bad news is we still got the country's worst problem. What is the most resistant to being cleaned?
So for this report showed that we have the worst of ground level ozone pollution in the country, and the emissions that cause that ground level ozone are primarily coming from what we call combustion sources. And it's mostly the vehicles, the trains, the trucks, the cars, the planes, the ships, the trains that are moving goods around our area. So the primary issue we have is finding a way to reduce emissions from those types of sources.
My sense is because the economy's booming that we see a lot more trucks, for example. Certainly there are many more cars on the road. Has that meant an increase in air pollution locally?
Yeah, so definitely since the recession, there has been an increase in business activity as well as goods movement activity. But fortunately, over that same period, cleaner trucks are making their way on the road. As someone buys a new truck, they have to meet the latest standards. Those trucks are cleaner than the ones being retired. So we continue to see emission reductions. The issue is they're not fast enough to meet some of the upcoming federal deadlines.
What effect have the large fires in Southern California over the past couple of years had on our ranking for air quality, particularly soot?
So when we have a large wildfire, the main impact is not on ground-level ozone, but on particulate matter, very small particles, invisible particles in the atmosphere. The American Lung Association report ranked us fifth in the country for PM2.5, the worst being in the Central Valley of California. When we have a wildfire locally or even up north in the state with the winds blowing south, it can have some dramatic impacts on PM2.5. But those days are not necessarily included as part of our measurement towards meeting the standards. They're called exceptional events. However, they do have significant health impacts. We respond with extra monitoring and advisories, letting people know what to do under those conditions.
And, Philip, what effect does either drought or higher than typical rain have on air quality, you know, particularly in our winters?
So our worst PM2.5 episodes come in the wintertime, which is increasingly where we're getting our wildfires as well. When it's a rainy winter, that helps cleanse the atmosphere. The stormy weather helps mix the atmosphere, and the winds will blow the pollution and disperse the pollution. Therefore, we get lower levels of PM2.5 when there's higher levels of rain in our wintertime smog period. However, when it's a drought, we have less rain, less of that cleansing, and we get higher PM2.5 levels. And that really did occur over the last couple years. In 2016, 2017, we saw an uptick in PM2.5, although, again, there has been a great improvement over the last couple decades in PM2.5.
So we could expect 2018-19 rainy season. We might have done pretty well on that.
Yeah, actually, preliminary data from 2018 shows a pretty good year for PM2.5, reversing the trend of the previous 2 years that showed that uptick.
All right. So rain is our friend in multiple ways. We're talking with the South Coast Air Quality Management District Deputy Executive Officer Philip Fine. He runs the Planning, Rural Development, and Area Resources Division of AQMD. I'd like to hear from you, particularly if you're a longtime Angeleno. Take us back for some of our younger listeners or more recent arrivals to what it was like here. I mean, yeah, we're talking about the challenges still here. It looks like it's going to be tough to meet the federal air pollution standards. I don't mean to minimize what we deal with today, but I just think, you know, sort of knee-jerk reaction for those of us that are longer time residents. We remember how truly awful the air quality was here and how much better it is now. I'd love to hear your reminiscences on that. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. KPECC infrastructure correspondent Sharon McNary is with me. She grew up in Hawthorne. I was in Inglewood as a kid. Man, do you remember even in those coastal communities how bad the smog was, Sharon?
Yeah, actually, it's Gardena. I went to school at Purchase Avenue Elementary at Gardena, and there were days when we were not permitted out for recess or they would cancel the organized games. You could hear the airplanes going overhead toward LAX, but you could not see them.
That's right. I forgot about that.
And not only that, you know, it's a seasonal joke that in the winter, you know, the mountains like run out and just show themselves because we haven't seen them all summer. And still, that's still a little bit of a thing. And, you know, I'm a runner. I'm a triathlete. And I like to brag a little bit and tell my friends, look, I'm a native Angeleno. I don't trust air. I can't chew. Because people say, how could you run in all of that smog? But things have gotten so much better. You know, I mean, when we studied the indigenous people when we were in third and fourth grades, they told us that the LA Basin was known as the Valley of the Smokes, just because the geography, you know, we're a valley surrounded by mountains that opens out to the ocean. That smog gets trapped under this layer of whatever it is. I'm not a scientist.
Yeah.
And it just piles up and piles up. And that was happening even centuries ago.
Dana, didn't he write in 2 years before the mast, I think, talked about seeing all this haze over Los Angeles.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is with only indigenous Californians living there at the time.
Exactly. But then if you go back to World War II, 1943, I had to do a history of smog back when I was an intern at the Herald Examiner. In 1943, one of the first really bad inversion layers trapped all this smog in, and people didn't know what it was. And it's like, well, you know, are our enemies in war trying to poison us? People would wear the gas masks they got with their protective gear for the war. And it took until about the 50s for a Caltech professor to collect some air and analyze it. And he said, no, it's coming from our tailpipes. And, you know, AQMD has a fabulous archive about smog. And I remember watching a stop motion film of one day in Los Angeles. And it might have been incineration day. You know, back in the days, we all had backyard incineration. Yeah, you'd burn your trash on the day after laundry day, so you wouldn't mess up your laundry. And it would show clean air in the morning. And as the day rolled on, it would get fuller and fuller and fuller of just dark, gray, nasty stuff.
Wow. And we just breathed it, went out, exercised. I remember my lungs burning on some of those days that it would be, even going to the beach, if there was a Santa Ana condition and would blow all the particulates out to the beach. And just, I remember wheezing and my lungs hurting.
Horrible. And people don't realize how much we've done collectively to reduce how bad that was. I mean, you can complain about our high gas prices.
Yeah.
You go to Arizona, you're paying $1, $1.50 less for gas, but it's very polluting gas. So, I mean, we live here. It's a beautiful place, but there are definitely expenses and collective actions we've had to take to keep the smog even as low as it is now, even though it's the worst in the country still.
Let's talk with Kathy in Long Beach. Kathy, good to have you with us.
Hi, my mother-in-law was born in 1917 in Pasadena. She was born with a hole in her heart. So in her 20s, her doctor said, you have to get out of here, move to the beach. So her grandparents owned a hunting lodge in Sunset Beach. So she ended up living in the beach area for the rest of her life, and she lived till she was 93.
Wow, even with the heart condition. Kathy, it's funny because so many people came to Pasadena, wealthy Midwesterners, back before and around the turn of the century because of the idea it was so healthful to come out here and particularly to winter here in Pasadena. But ironic that your mother was told she had to leave because of air pollution. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Eric, in the city of Orange, what are your memories of those particularly awful air pollution days?
Hey, Larry. When I was a kid, for 3 years, I grew up in Riverside. And at that time, in the early 1970s, the smog would be so bad, it would be blown in, presumably from the L.A. Basin over Riverside. And my brother and I would have to actually call a recorded number and find out if the air quality was safe enough for us to go outside and play. And most often it was not.
Yeah. Yeah. In that, I mean, it's just, and of course, in the summer when you're off school that you could play. Yeah. Eric, thank you for sharing that. 866-893-KPCC. I remember in third or fourth grade, I was walking home from Sentinella Avenue Elementary School in Inglewood. And all of a sudden, Mount Baldy was like sitting. I was like, where did that come from? And I remember it was so startling. I was so unused to seeing a mountain that far away. But it was one of those ultra clear Santa Ana days, probably.
Well, and Eric is mentioning he was in Riverside County. A lot of people don't realize the Air Quality Management District is the air basin. So it's not just Los Angeles County. It's L.A., Orange, Riverside, San Bernardino. I think it even extends up some out in the desert. But it's the geography where this the
smog, inversion layer place.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when you talk about everybody getting together and doing things to make things better, I mean, it's everything from, you know, pushing the ports to have cleaner trucks and electric gantry cranes. There's just so many things we've done, and there's still so much more to do, like telling industries they can't pollute, or the refineries. You know, just the face of LA has changed in large part because of the work of this agency.
You were mentioning, we were talking about Riverside County, and wasn't the thought originally that, well, it was in incinerators, smudge pots for the orchards that were the problem? People didn't really realize that cars were the biggest single polluter.
Well, I think Philip might know more about that. But yeah, I mean, there's stuff that puts particles into the air, but then there's also these byproducts of the combustion of gasoline that are especially polluting. And I don't even know if those are so visible, but they're really bad on your lungs.
Philip Fine, AQMD, you want to comment on that? I mean, how we sort of figured out the true sources of all the particulates?
Yeah, so originally, I think it was the direct emissions from those sources you mentioned, incinerators and smudge pots and other industries. And you could see them coming out of the smokestacks. And those were the first targets for control. And then they were controlled, but people still saw the pollution. And that's when in the 50s, Dr. Ari Hagenschmidt at Caltech did the studies to figure out about ground-level ozone. But also, particulate matter is not just formed directly on those emissions. There's gases that come out of tailpipes that once they react in the air will also form particulate matter. So there was a lot of work done early to control the direct emissions, and even now the direct emissions are very, very low. It's what we call those secondary pollutants, that these gases are emitted, they transform in the atmosphere and form the ground-level ozone and the particulate matter pollution that we're tackling still today.
A listener remembering the RTD buses, those are now the Metro bus, of course, giving off big plumes of black soot. Nobody seemed to care. In fact, I remember TV ads for the RTD where the bus would be going down the street and you see the big, you know, exhaust come up from it. And it's just, yeah, no one thought of that.
Well, and you remember my intern project at the Herald Examiner, I went back into the clips and I found that the very first citation that the local smog cops issued for it was particulate matter. It was a steakhouse right next door to City Hall.
How funny. That's hilarious. Philip, you were going to say something. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, it's okay, Larry.
All right. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Anthony said, my friend's mom moved to Redondo Beach in the 70s. She lived there for a year before she realized there were mountains in Los Angeles.
Where did those come from?
Yeah. All right. Let's see. Let's talk next with Michael in Newport Beach. Michael, you grew up in the San Gabriel Valley?
Yeah. Hi, Larry. Hi. Sure did. Covina in late 60s and playing football, and the coaches would never call off practices, and remembering the lungs and those feelings. And, you know, here, you know, recently I know what heart attacks are. So, and that feeling of just not, and you could not see the mountains from Covina. And now I live in Newport Beach, and almost every day, even in the summertime, I can see the mountains. And I get a little bitchy about when the gas goes over $4, but you know what? So what? And what they've done in this town is awesome.
All right, Michael, thanks. Philip Fine of the AQMD. My sense was that the catalytic converter was really the game changer. I know there was a lot of stuff going on, but where do you place that in terms of the effectiveness of cleanup?
I think it was a game changer. The catalytic converter, removing lead from gasoline, removing sulfur from the fuels, those things really did clean up, had dramatic effects on cleaning up our air. What we still struggle with today is more the heavy-duty sector. The cars are getting much cleaner. We're moving to zero-emission light-duty vehicles, but it's that heavy-duty equipment that is emitting the pollution that's leading to our smog problems today. We all work very hard to try to reduce those emissions as quickly as possible, but again, it's not coming down as fast as we need it to.
Jose in Redondo Beach says, growing up in Burbank in the 70s, we'd have football practice outdoors regardless of how bad the smog was. Some days so thick we could feel ourselves breathing it, sometimes a number of teammates would get physically ill from the air pollution. Gordon in Newport Beach, I grew up in Laguna. When I was young, I'd feel the pain of that smog deep in my chest. Isn't it funny? I still can, it's like a sense memory for me, Sharon, of
very
that lung
so.
Burning.
Very much so, yeah.
Yeah, Astrogoth says, actually sort of misses that. I don't know about that. definitely don't miss that. Adriana in Elysian Park says, I'm younger, Angelino. I've grown up hearing my mom say that in the 70s you couldn't see the foothills, but I don't think we should give ourselves too much credit. We are still always topping the list for bad air quality. We need more regulation. And Philip Fine, what's coming in that way?
Well, as a local air quality management district in our region, our primary responsibility is for stationary sources. So, yes, it is the refineries, the power plants, all the way down to your local gas station. And we continue to pass regulations on all those sources. We're required to by state law and federal law, and we continue to do that. Our challenge is that 80% of the smog-forming pollutants are coming from mobile sources, and we have limited regulatory authority. That authority lies largely with the state, the California Air Resources Board, on the mobile sources, as well as the federal government, the U.S. EPA, and in some cases some international organizations when it comes to aircraft or ships. So we need help from those partner agencies in order to meet our clean air goals.
Jack asks if the district is pursuing a half-cent sales tax. If so, how much would that raise?
Roughly, if the voters did approve a half-cent sales tax, and the reason for that would be to fund incentive programs where we can quickly change over the older, dirtier equipment for zero or near-zero emission equipment. A half-cent sales tax roughly in our area would roughly raise about $1.5 billion a year. We calculate that in order to transform Southern California's heavy-duty equipment fleet to what we need it to be for clean air, it's going to cost about $1 to $2 billion a year.
So this would cover that.
This would cover that, and again, we don't have the regulatory authority to require those cleaner trucks. But even if the state and federal governments pass regulations, it takes a much longer time frame to actually implement those regulations. The sales tax would get us those gains much earlier and avoid a lot of premature death and other health impacts in Southern California.
Sharon.
I think that's going to be a huge challenge. I mean, you know, Southern Californians have shown themselves to be very willing to be taxed again and again. We've approved a half cent for transit. We've got a parcel tax for, you know, water, storm runoff.
The schools are putting one on.
So this is really, this will be a great test of whether our willingness to continue taxing ourselves. Property, I mean, sales taxes are nearing 10% in some parts of LA County. Some cities, you know, local cities put on their quarter cent, their half cent, their 1 cent. So I think it's going to be a real test.
So we top the country in air pollution and top it in sales tax.
Yeah, you want to live here, man, just bring money.
We're a leader, yeah. Cloud says, don't forget the steel mill in Fontana. Oh, yeah, the Kaiser plant. He said, huge source of air pollution in Cloud's childhood. Thanks so much for being with us. Philip Fine, South Coast Air Quality Management District Deputy Executive Officer. Philip, thank you so much. Really appreciate your being with us. And Sharon McNary, KPCC Infrastructure correspondent. Always a pleasure, Sharon.
Yay.
And, you know, we talk about bad news and air pollution, all, but nice to also celebrate all the progress we have made, which is a lot. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Great to have you with us today. Coming up in just a few minutes, Merriam-Webster adding to its dictionary words several hundred new definitions or altogether new words. We'll talk about some of them that are making the cut, like swole, buzzy, on brand, others that have made the new dictionary's edition. We'll talk about that. But first, with sports betting becoming legalized in states across the country, broadcasters are trying to find ways of getting in the game so that they could leverage their sports coverage from a gambling perspective. ESPN, with its platforms, has already embraced sports betting, and it's expected that other programmers are going to do similarly. With us, sports business reporter for Bloomberg News, Eben Novy Williams. Eben, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
So what are some of the ways beyond, you know, initially obvious, like Scott Van Pelt's SportsCenter on ESPN, you know, looking at specific, you know, sports betting sort of stuff? What are some of the other ways maybe we're not even seeing yet that they're starting to adapt to this?
Yeah, there's a whole host of things that everybody is looking at, whether you're Fox Sports or ESPN or, you know, digital first companies like Verizon's Yahoo. The main one, you know, the biggest one is advertising, right? If you remember the daily fantasy sports advertising deluge that we had in this country back in 2015 and 2016, that, from what I understand, will pale in comparison to the nationwide gambling advertising blitz that is coming as more and more states come online. I live here out in New York, but I spent some time in New Jersey as well. You can't move right now in parts of New Jersey without seeing an advertisement for DraftKings, an advertisement for FanDuel. This is both, you know, on the radio, this is on TV, this is, you know, banner ads at Penn Station in Newark. It's all over. So.
Signage at games. They've strategically placed at many events.
Exactly. So advertising is a huge one. If you're ESPN, you know, the games that you're televising in states that have legal sports betting, you're able to sell local ads to, you know, local sports betting operators. So that's a massive one. And the other biggest part one is referral fees. You know, this is a part of the industry that not a lot of people know about, but if you're ESPN and you have a partnership with, let's say, Caesars, and Caesars has a banner ad on the side of your website, and people click through to Caesars from that banner ad, the agreement there is that ESPN can get a cut of either the person's first donation or for the lifetime of that person gambling at Caesars, a cut of the money that they gamble.
Wow.
And that's another massive one. So referral fees are another way, you know, all these big media companies are thinking about, you know, ways they can profit off of sports betting.
What about the leaks themselves? I've seen, you know, different deals cut. You mentioned Caesars or MGM. What is that about? I don't quite understand how the leagues are going to be working with those companies.
Yeah, it's a great question, and we could talk for hours about the many different ways the leagues are trying to figure out the ways to make money off this. The simple answer is that, you know, most of the deals you're seeing right now are marketing deals. Okay. You know, in the same way that there is an official car, an official tire, and an official beer of the NFL, there's also an official casino partner. So leagues have been signing deals that give that. The other main way that leagues are trying to make money is a thing called integrity fees or data fees, whatever you want to call it. Leagues are trying to make sure that operators have to pay them for the right to set up live betting or gambling on their games. So that's another way that leagues are kind of trying to get a slice of the pie.
How would leagues enforce that, though? Because, you know, for example, you know, Vegas, where there's abundant sports game, they don't pay the leagues anything, right?
Exactly. And that's the argument that you hear from Caesars and William Hill and MGM, you know, that sports betting has existed in Las Vegas for decades and this fee has never been passed along. The way that I think the leagues are going to get around that is that they're building their own, you know, specific data streams, right? So, you know, if you know, you're watching the Yankees play the Red Sox and there's a pitch that gets hit, you know, whether that's a hit or an error, what the official scoring was, up to date, up to the second, you know, all that data, Major League Baseball is trying to make that proprietary so that if you are a sportsbook operator and you want to allow a gambler in California to bet on whether the next pitch is a ball or a strike, they want it so that you have to buy that data from Major League Baseball. Because if you're trying to do it just off the TV feed or off the radio feed, you're going to be so far behind, you're not going to be able to make to offer that bet.
All right. Bloomberg News sports business reporter Eben Novy Williams with us on Air Talk. For those of us that are big sports fans but not sports gamblers, is the experience of watching the game going forward going to be dramatically different? And do you think it's going to be distracting for the fan who just is interested in the game for the game's sake?
I think there are definitely people out there who will probably be a little turned off in the next couple of years by the amount at which, you know, people on, you know, broadcasters are talking about it. I personally kind of subscribe to this feeling that, you know, in a couple of years, sports fans are going to be able to kind of pick whatever kind of telecast they want. You know, ESPN has played around with this with the college football championship game. But, you know, I can see a world where in the future you're choosing between having the gambling feed, you know, where your broadcasters are talking kind of exclusively about, you know, what are the odds in this and this, and, you know, what is the payout for this, and what are we going to see coming up here, versus, you know, an X's and O's broadcast where two former coaches talk in depth, or a beginner broadcast where people who don't understand the rules of football are able to sit there and get it explained to them as they watch. I think in the future we're going to see kind of a big fragmentation of the types of broadcasts. But in the near term, yes, I think, you know, gambling is still, for a lot of people, kind of a taboo corner of the business world, and a lot of people still think of it as kind of a dark industry.
Well, and I'm even thinking of clutter, just, you know, sort of clutter for the viewer. But
sure, yeah, and I think that's also true. You know, we're just kind of getting into the first stages of, you know, people who are officially calling games really addressing it. And yeah, there's no question that, you know, as it becomes more mainstream, you know, right now there's only 8 states that are offering legal sports bets. As that becomes bigger and bigger, and a bigger slice of the national audience for games is sitting in states where they can do it legally, you're definitely going to see more of it creeping into broadcast.
I think a couple of states, was it Montana and Iowa, are looking at legalization this week. So
I think Tennessee just passed one today in the House. So if that gets passed in the Tennessee Senate, I think you're going to see the governor sign that, and ideally have legal sports betting in Tennessee starting before football season.
Wow. Evan, thanks so much for talking with us about the significant changes we're going to be seeing for sports fans with the increasing number of states that are legalizing sports gambling. Thanks very much.
For sure, Larry. Thank you.
Evan Novy-Williams, Bloomberg News sports business reporter. Coming up, we'll take a look at Merriam-Webster's editions of new definitions as well as new words that are included in the latest edition. You can also suggest a recently coined meaning or word that you'd like to see included formally in the dictionary. We'll be back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdy's. Well, that's why we have Merriam-Webster's dictionary, so that we've got the words easily available. And just like other published dictionaries, they've got to keep up on the latest trends in definitions or brand new words recently created but that have become popularly accepted. And there are 640 new words or definitions included in the new edition of Merriam-Webster's dictionary just announced this week. With us is Peter Sobolowski, who is the editor-at-large for Merriam-Webster. Peter, thank you for joining us.
It's great to be with you.
I was very happy to see that a man who so many of us here in Southern California loved and admired, Chick Hearn's term, garbage time, made it into your dictionary. That's long overdue. I'm very happy to see that.
It's a great entry for the dictionary, and I happen to love the image that it presents.
Yeah, it's just great. Chick Hearn, by the way, coined a number of— slam dunk was another Hearnism.
Really?
Yes, he coined many of them back starting in the 1960s on Los Angeles Laker broadcasts. Peter, let's talk about some of the others here. And first, what are the standards for inclusion? How do you figure out when it's reached the mainstream enough and you've got to have it in the book?
Well, you've got the essential element right there. It's reached the mainstream. So often, for example, with garbage time, it would start among just sports aficionados, you know, basketball lovers maybe, and, you know, used only among broadcasters and then maybe big major fans and then players, and then it would spread into the print journalism and then finally into the sort of general vocabulary. So it's really the movement from the specific to the general, you know, from every field, every profession has its own jargon. And those words have to kind of break out of the narrow field and enter the mainstream to be in our dictionary, because, you know, what we're trying to present is the current active vocabulary of American English. So, you know, it is not going to have all of the super specific words from, you know, lepidoptery or something. And every profession, yours and mine, will have words that will never be in the dictionary, because only people who use them are the people inside that, you know, closed community. Garbage time is a good example of a word that's moved on.
I'd love to hear from AirTalk listeners. Do you have a recommendation for a word you're pretty sure isn't included in formal dictionaries, but that you think really should be, or a definition? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Is there a panel of people, Peter, that make this decision?
No, it's the whole staff. There's no committee and there's no advocacy per se. Basically, we all keep our eyes open. The first step is to notice. We notice either a new term or a new use of an existing term, and then we will put it into our general new words file, usually with a draft definition and some citations. That's the important part. The quotations or citations, evidence of the word in use. And once we get a kind of critical mass of that evidence, then we can draft a definition, because we can see from the context the way the word is used. And that's it's a process that in some cases is very fast. A word like blog took maybe 3 or 4 years from coinage to dictionary publication. Other words take decades. Every single word has its own pace. And what we do is it's not so much a question of approval as of waiting. You know, if a word isn't quite making the cut, we'll just say, let's wait another year, because the research is ongoing.
Let's talk about some of the new meanings of existing words. These are words that were in the Merriam-Webster dictionary but now have an additional meaning, snowflake, which, you know, we know the literal expression, but has come to mean someone perceived to be overly sensitive.
Exactly.
So, yeah, that's one. And that's happened again pretty quickly. It's just been in the past, gosh, it seems like 3 years we've heard that expression.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fascinating word. You know, there's another sense, there's a third sense, someone regarded or treated as a unique or special person. You know, that's that is, of course, related to the overly sensitive use that's found in social media. And it's true that social media is kind of like an accelerant to language change, isn't it? Because, I mean, it just everything happens so quickly and is communicated so quickly. And it's clear that this is a word that was adopted widely on social media and has become, obviously, a new and accepted use of the term.
We have a listener, Rob, wondering, is e-ticket included?
Oh, I think it is. I mean,
it's been around forever, but I was wondering if it's formally recognized.
You know what? It's, you know, e-tailor, and we have e as a productive prefix, shall we say, and, you know, that it indicates that it's, you know, electronic.
I hadn't thought of e-tailor. That's
right. So we do have e as a combining form. So e hyphen whatever else. But I agree that e-ticket deserves its own entry, and that's the thing, is that even though we have a generic entry for that combining form, once one of those combined forms is used very frequently, then we put it in. You know, for compound terms like garbage time, for example, you know, you can look up garbage and you can look up time and you'll never come up with, you know, the fact that one team has a lead that is, you know, very far ahead of the other team. And so those are terms that need definitions.
Speaking of compound terms, Go Cup made its way in for the mugs that we carry with a lid. Screen time, that's funny, because that's taken quite a few years to be included.
It has in a certain sense, although it had this is a new sense because screen time existed before, and it meant something else. It was a Hollywood term for the amount of time in front of the camera, and that is to say, the amount of time that a star appeared on the screen, and that goes back to the golden age of Hollywood to the 1920s. That meaning, and now it's turned around completely because now it's the amount of time spent, of course, in front of a screen, whether it's a television or a computer screen or a tablet, and so screen time has sort of turned around. We now have we give two senses to it.
We're talking with Merriam-Webster's editor-at-large, Peter Sokolowski, who joins us to talk about all the new meanings as well as words that are included in the latest edition of Merriam-Webster's dictionary. Just this week, they announced them. We're taking your recommendations at 866-893-KPCC or 866-893-5722. Look forward to having you join us. Here's a recommendation, Bottle Episode, an inexpensively produced episode of a TV series typically confined to one setting. I've never heard that term, Bottle Episode. Have you, Peter?
No, that was new to me, I have to say. That was new to me. You know, with every one of these lists of new terms, the reaction from most people that I encounter is that, you know, some of the words, hey, I've been using that for decades. I've always used that. We always use that in the household. And then there will be others that they will say, hey, you just made that up. I've never heard that in my life. And that probably means we're getting it just about right because, you know, everybody's vocabulary is different and everybody's encounter with language is different. And so in this case, I'm not enough of a scholar. Of cable episodic television, I don't think, to know Bottle Episode. But it's a great and evocative term.
You have three that I see here that have to do with gender or transitions. There's gender nonconforming. Then there's top surgery and bottom surgery, which those expressions refer to a specific surgery for gender confirmation. So those have been included this year.
Absolutely. And we have an entry for gender confirmation surgery itself. And, you know, it's funny, just listening to the news this morning with a preview of the Supreme Court docket, we hear issues of gender and equal rights. But there are issues that have to do with rights, with identity, with obviously with procedures and medical definitions. And so this is simply the dictionary reflecting our times, as it always does, by the way. I mean, the dictionary. You know, entered all the words for the steam engine and locomotion in the 1840s and 50s, you know, and so you can actually follow in a chronological way, you can follow the development of the language in a very particular way, especially regarding the culture and technology.
One of our producers sort of taking issue with my limited definition of Go Cup, saying, what about Las Vegas and New Orleans, where you take your Go Cup for carrying a different beverage? I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, and New Orleans is mentioned in the definition itself.
Oh, how funny.
it says a paper or plastic cup used especially for taking a beverage off the premises of a bar, restaurant, etc., especially such a cup used as in New Orleans for carrying an alcoholic beverage. And I love that. I have done that myself as a citizen of Massachusetts. It is always astonishing that you can walk out of a bar
with your drink in hand. Yeah.
Exactly.
All right, 866-893-KPCC. We'll be back with more about the newest words and meanings included in Merriam-Webster's updated dictionary. You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Excuse me. We're talking about new entries in Merriam-Webster's updated dictionary and how quickly we add new words. With us as well as psycholinguist and professor emerita at Boston University, Jean Berko Gleason. Professor, thank you for being with us.
Hi, Larry.
I'm sorry, what?
I said it's great to join you from sunny Boston.
Oh, yeah, good. I appreciate it very much. I'm wondering about, is the pace of language picking up through social media, or have we always created new words and meanings at this pace?
Well, I think it probably is a little faster. You know, nobody's. It's very, very hard to measure something like that. But we do know that, for instance, when languages are in contact with other languages, they change faster. And now what we have is a world in which people are traveling around and going to different places, and social media is moving things. So I think probably the fact that there's so much more connection between different language speakers, different speakers of different kinds of language, that's going to make for faster change. You know, languages that are isolated don't change as fast.
Bill in the San Gabriel Valley asked about a couple of recent words, Latinx, which is a new word. Like Latino, it means either Latino or Latina. Meh, M-E-H, another one. Do you think, Professor, that those are worthy of inclusion?
Oh, yes. Well, what's the, I think the point is that you include what people are using. The dictionary isn't deciding whether it's a good word or not. It's deciding whether or not it's in use, whether it's in broad use. And if people are saying meh all over the country, then I think it belongs there.
Also, Belinda wonders if cisgender is in any of the formal dictionaries. Peter, so we've got three words, Latinx, cisgender, meh. Are any of those three included?
All three, and also cis by itself. And so, you know, the professor is right. Professor Gleason nailed it. You know, if a word is used, it goes in the dictionary. We are not the avant-garde, and we're also not the traffic cop. You know, we are here to report on the facts of the language. You know, the real mission is to tell the truth about words. And if many people use the same word to mean the same thing, it belongs in the dictionary, because that's the only way the dictionary is useful, really, when you think about it.
Dan in Sherman Oaks wonders how acronyms are handled when they become words, like YOLO for you only live once, FOMO, fear of missing out. How do you handle that?
Yeah, I mean, those are coming up for sure. I think there was one or two in this list, and we enter acronyms and initialisms, as we call them, the ones that you pronounce the letters for, like FBI, for example. And so a word like radar is an acronym, NATO, but initialism. We make this distinction between initialisms and acronyms, and they go in, if they're used as a noun frequently, we will identify them as a noun, but usually they are shown as abbreviations. The part of speech we give is simply abbreviation.
All right. We have a number of listeners just wanted to make clear about the e-ticket reference. That was, of course, Disneyland's most valuable ticket, the Matterhorn and other things like that. So when you say something's an e-ticket ride, you mean the very best. 866-893-KPCC. Kathy in Malibu wonders, creative activist, is that a compound that's made it into the dictionary? Her organization started using that term. She now finds it everywhere, but her firm's been using it for 2 decades.
Wow. That's new to me. There is an interesting thing about these compounds, because if they are self-evident, there was a long prejudice when we were limited in space on the printed page, there was a long prejudice against such things. So, for example, for many years, there was no entry for orange juice in the dictionary, because you could look up orange and you could look up juice. There's no entry for cattle ranch, but there is an entry for dude ranch, you know, because you can't derive its meaning from the two constituent words. And in this case, creative activist, I would say, just from the distance I have, it seems self-evident to me, and therefore it just will take a little longer. Orange juice is now in our dictionary for one reason and one reason only, because it's such a very frequent compound.
All right. So here's another one where there's an additional meaning, Goldilocks.
Yeah,
because
I love that.
We've heard this more recently, Peter.
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously a fairy tale can become a metaphor itself. And this is used in several fields, not just science, but astronomers use it to describe an area of planetary orbit in which temperatures are neither too hot nor too cold to support life. And that's so they say a Goldilocks planet, for example, or a Goldilocks zone. And that's really fascinating. And that's the way it's gotten into the dictionary. It's used in some financial settings as well. Goldilocks stocks, for example, are neither, you know, too high or too low yielding to be very risky, that kind of thing.
Also, we have a listener wondering, how many words do you take out or meanings do you take out? Is it as many as you add each year?
Not at all. In fact, because of the online, you know, presentation, we are no longer limited. I mean, the big story of the history of, you know, the printed dictionary the last 400 years in English is that you're limited in space, and that the construction of the dictionary definition was made to be very elliptical and short, and often hard to read, I will admit. But now with unlimited space online, we can not only add more words, we can add more detail and more examples. And so the fact is we aren't taking words out of the online dictionary. From the print dictionary, some things came out. They tended to be, by the way, the other side of the coin of what we just talked about with the self-evident things. A word that was dropped in our last print edition was crossbowman, one who wields a crossbow.
All right. Brandon Westwood wondering, shade, do you have the newer definition of shade?
That's a really, really good question. And I'm going to look at, yes, to throw shade is entered into.
Throw shade. All right. Hey, Peter, thanks. This has been a lot of fun. Really appreciate it.
It's a treat to be with you. And thank you, Professor Gleason.
Thank you. Editor-at-Large Merriam-Webster, Peter Sokolowski joining us. And Jean Berko Gleason is psycholinguist, professor emeritus, Boston University. Professor, thank you so much. We could do this as a regular feature. We have so many words we didn't even get to. Have a terrific afternoon. Fresh Air with Terry Gross comes up next. Tomorrow I'm going to be joined by the head of the Cannabis Bureau for California, Lori Ajax. Also, my son Desmond joins me for Take Your Son and Daughter to Work Day. Have a great afternoon.